plugs play pedagogy. Welcome to episode one of Plugs Play Pedagogy, a Writing Commons production produced in cooperation with Kairos Cast. It's August 2014. I'm Kyle Stedman from Rockford University, and I'm going to use this show to explore all the complicated aspects of teaching writing and rhetoric, especially teaching writing and rhetoric with digital technology. And that's the idea behind the title, Plugs Play Pedagogy. So often my teaching involves things that I plug in, right? I'm always plugging my laptop into power cables, projector cables, USB microphone cables, speaker cables, and so on. And all those plugs give me tools that I can use to play around in my classroom, to create a sense of play for students, along with all the connotations of achievement and excitement that goes along with that word play, you know? There's also a sense of play that goes into pedagogical innovation. I know I'm always trying new things in class, which never work out exactly as I expect them to, even when the innovations are based on solid theory, but I play around and I keep going. And notice that the title is three words separated by commas or slashes or whatever. It's not plug and play, it's plugs, comma, play. I think plug and play would suggest a sort of super easy approach to pedagogy, this one-size-fits-all approach, the suggestion that I'm going to give you simple tips that will solve all your problems. And as we all know, teaching is messier than that. So as a practitioner, as a teacher at a teaching institution, I want to start a conversation with you guys about the theory and practice of what we do. The form of that conversation will change month to month as I learn new things and you share new things with me. That's right. I want to hear your feedback. I want to hear your ideas for show elements, your volunteering to produce show elements, hint, hint, your suggestion of new books and articles that are just dying to be talked about out loud. That's what podcasts are good for, after all, especially anything that focuses on the digital technology aspects of pedagogy. So email me at plugsplaypedagogy@writingcommons.org, or you can always tweet me at kstedman. Use the plugsplay hashtag if you want, because no one can spell pedagogy anyway, right? Right. Okay, so today's episode is about setting up class. I'm recording this in early August, that time of year when so many of us are prepping in so many different ways. And really, it makes me think about my first teaching gig. I taught high school English to 10th graders right after I graduated from college. I was only 22, and I thought I could make my high school classes be just like the English classes I had had in college, which was obviously kind of silly. So the first time I walked into my classroom a few weeks before school started, I saw that it was decorated very childishly. There were these motivational posters everywhere with cartoonish font. There were other cartoons on every wall, and everything was laminated. It was as if the room's walls had been covered in plastic wrap. There was so much light glinting off of the laminated posters. And I was freaked out. I hadn't once considered that a room would need decorating. I had been thinking about everything else. I'd been reading The Odyssey for the first time, devising brilliant lesson plans about how my students would just love to talk about it all the time. So what I did, and I don't remember if this was my idea or my wife's or if it was planned or serendipitous or what, but what I did was I bought 20 or 30 old National Geographic magazines from the used bookstore down at the downtown Orlando library. And I cut all of the covers off. Yeah, it felt a little bad, but they were old. They needed some love anyway. I cut all the covers off. And I stapled them to the giant bulletin board outside of my classroom. No words, just National Geographic images. I was teaching world literature, so it seemed appropriate. And by the way, I had never taken a world literature class in college, but I was teaching it to high schoolers anyway. So then I took the best maps from all those magazines that I destroyed, and I sent them down to the laminating machine, which I admit was kind of cooler than I expected. And I covered the walls with those maps. So here's the point of my high school classroom story. Even though I don't decorate my classroom now when I'm teaching rhetoric and writing at Rockford University, I still have those pre-class moments of uncertainty when I realize that I have to get a lot of stuff set up and that it's going to take more of my time and creativity than I may have initially imagined. I don't know if you've ever been there. And for writing classes in the 21st century, cutting up some magazines usually isn't enough to cut it. Instead, I'm setting up lots of digital tools and digital spaces that I might be more or less familiar with. So today's episode, the inaugural episode, The August inaugural episode, the august occasion of this August inaugural episode is about setting up class. I invited people, you all, to tell me success stories, 1 minute success stories. I mean, who can say anything in 1 minute, but these amazing people did. 1 minute success stories about what they do online to prepare for classes each semester, especially focusing on their use of digital tools. But before we hear those successes all nice and laminated for you, I want you to hear a couple of stories about when everything didn't work quite as well as expected, when the instructor tried to use digital tools and start conversations. So for help telling those stories, I called on this illustrious group of 4 faculty and graduate students at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. I know I'm not supposed to say Norfolk, but I can't do it. I knew this was a group that was particularly used to teaching and taking classes in online environments, so I also suspected deep down that things might not always have gone swimmingly for them. So let's start with a story from Shelley Rodrigo.
I learned the hard way the difference between an HTML link that includes the code target equals blank can make a big difference in a student's ability to learn. As a way to make sure all online students knew where to find getting started information about their courses, Mesa Community College made it a policy for all online courses to at least start in the official LMS, which at that time was Blackboard. I understood and agreed with this, quote, taking online students through the same doorway, unquote, policy. However, I was one of the faculty who taught my classes elsewhere. Therefore, I posted one announcement in the Blackboard shell that said, this course is held at a different site, and then pasted in the URL to the new site. Of course, I suggested that the students bookmark the site in the browser, but that didn't mean they followed my suggestion. During the first couple semesters of that rule, I always had at least a few students who really struggled with using the applications I wanted, usually WordPress, Delicious or Digo, and MindMeister. What I didn't realize until 3 or 4 semesters later, when a student shared his screen with me, is that some students would always go to the course by first logging into Blackboard. And then, because I did not check that the link was coded as target equals blank, aka open this link in a new tab or window, I had students who were trying to work within the WordPress environment while still logged into and bogged down by the Blackboard wraparound framework. This example continues to remind me how and why it's important to at least understand how to look at the actual code and to be able to manipulate it as needed.
I think it makes sense to follow Shelley's story with another one about the failure to anticipate user experience, which I'm starting to think is a theme here because I know I have failed to anticipate that many, many times.
Hi, my name is Sarah Spangler. I'm a 3rd-year PhD student and sometimes instructor at Old Dominion University. My story is about a user interface semi-fail on a course website I designed a couple of years ago using Google Sites. At the time, I was working on converting a face-to-face intro to literature course to a hybrid model and had decided I wanted all the things to be digital and to be contained within the course site itself. As such, I had a lot of information to be organized in a user-friendly way. After tweaking the site in ways that I thought made good sense, I was mostly pleased with my foray into using Google Sites. However, despite spending a fair amount of time walking my students through the site, some students were struggling to locate information efficiently. Naturally, I blame my students and their inexperience as users because certainly it couldn't be the way I had designed the site. Plus, other students seemed to be trucking along just fine. But after a week or so and 2 or 3 student emails regarding the site's layout, I had no choice but to acknowledge that the navigation problems were likely a design issue and not simply my students' laziness or inability to navigate a website. After all, admittedly, I had neglected to conduct any user testing prior to the beginning of the semester. So how did I address this? For starters, I openly acknowledged the issue in class. I said that a few students had brought to my attention that they found the course site to be slightly difficult to navigate and locate important information. I asked if anyone else was having similar issues. To my chagrin, not all, but a number of students nodded in agreement. Ugh. I proceeded to apologize for the difficulties and then asked if they would help me think through ways of better organizing the site so they could more easily find what they needed. It took all of 10 minutes for us to come up with some solutions. For me, this story serves as a reminder of how important user feedback is when designing a site, particularly if you're deploying a technology that is new to you.
Now let's hear 2 more, these ones focusing on the tricky issue of encouraging students to talk in online spaces and how that can go wrong.
So I once had this class in our program that required that you tweeted your reading responses. So you had to tweet a certain number of responses to a chapter and then respond to a certain number of tweets from your colleagues.
That's Megan Mize. And I should say that I'm already getting nervous because I've required students to use Twitter for all sorts of reasons. And sometimes it seems to be awesome and sometimes not. So yikes.
And then we were also required to live tweet during class time. Supposedly, we were supposed to talk about, you know, the very thoughtful things we were discussing so that our reading and our in-class discussion would be kind of put on a public display and so that I guess there would be a public record of the kind of evolution of our thoughts. The intent behind this assignment, I think, was pretty good. I think the actual impact was less effective than perhaps it could have been. In some ways, it really solidified this insider-outsider kind of status in that, for instance, during the live tweeting, those students who had been in the program longer or knew the professor better often felt more comfortable to tweet funnier material or more personal material that was happening in the class. So often our live stream was more conversational and less scholarly. And those of us who were newer or perhaps were less familiar with the professor or our colleagues would be less inclined to engage with that. So in terms of tweeting the homework, we were working with very dense theory, and you would, instead of getting interesting tweets in 140 characters, which is a good assignment, I think, but what would happen is instead we would say things like, I really liked chapter two, and someone would respond to, yeah, I also liked chapter two. And so that just was at times, it just felt like an obstacle rather than a really engaging assignment. And the final component that I think was a little bit troubling about it was that very public aspect in that, we were really pressed to use certain hashtags or try to reach out to particular scholars. And considering that a lot of us were fairly novice in the field, while I both think reaching out and trying to catch the attention of a scholar is a good idea, in that instance, I felt that when you're first getting your feet in the water, sometimes you maybe don't want the world having a record of your baby steps. So, you know, I think it could have been a good assignment, but certainly one that I think had some unintended effects.
So I was a grad student. I was pretty much my first semester teaching online professional writing.
That's Dan Richards, also from Old Dominion University, same as the three people before that. We talked for a little bit about setting up spaces to encourage vibrant conversations in online writing classes. This is a Google Hangout that I recorded.
And as a student, I was always frustrated with the way discussions would be led in asynchronous online classes. Primarily in Blackboard, you would write a post. It would be due Sunday at 11:59 p.m. And that was 20% of your grade was discussion. And there just wouldn't be that good of a discussion because everyone would just go on at 10 or 11 o'clock at night on Sunday and just kind of, you know, place something right on the page, just kind of splatter right on there, and it wasn't really a discussion. So I thought, well,
I've been there before. I mean, I remember being a grad student in online classes and thinking, hey, I'm a little bit better at this than other people. Is that bad to say?
I remember
thinking that I was kind of like me and a couple other people. You could tell we were the ones who were really into the online discussion stuff, but there were still plenty of weeks where I did what you're saying, where I totally forgot until 11:59, the night it was due.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would only, you know, I would post on Wednesday or Thursday, maybe sometimes if it was something that, you know, if I got to the reading early and there's something I really wanted to say and I didn't want to forget about it, you know. But that was, you're right, that was very rare. It was just more like, oh, it's Sunday night. It's like, you know, taking out the trash. It's just your weekly chore and it's just kind of what you did.
Right. So you were sick of that and you wanted to fix it in your own class.
Absolutely. Wanted to be radical. I had all these ideas about how I could get the undergraduate students to have a more organic, more honest, open, not necessarily laid back, but just kind of, you know, a discussion that happens naturally.
Yeah, and I like the word radical because it's kind of like a radical pedagogy in a serious sense, but it's also kind of Ninja Turtle, you know, like, hey, that's radical.
Yeah. And very timely because that movie's coming out, right?
Yeah.
I'm kind of excited to see how they just ruined one of my childhood, one of my great childhood memories. But
I know, it makes me sad.
Yeah, so that should be good. So, you know, I was thinking, I was mulling it over. I was thinking, like, how can I do this? There still has to be, you know, I racked my brain. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to tell them you need 15 posts due before the end of the semester. It was the fall semester. So I thought, as long as by December 12th, you had 15 posts, you know, semester started August 25th, whatever it was, then I would assess those 15 posts holistically and assign a letter grade based upon that. As opposed to me just checking off in Blackboard or having my own Excel spreadsheet and be like, did you know, Julie write her post today? Yes. Did Alfonso write his post today? Yes. And more like that, just kind of holistically assess their role as a discussant in the online environment.
And that was it. They just had to do 15 posts over the semester. No timeline.
I thought they would respond so well to it. I thought they'd be like, oh, this is great. You know, if I wake up on a Wednesday morning, I have something to say about this reading and professional writing, you know, then maybe, you know, then they should have the opportunity to do that.
Then you wake up on Thursday morning and you're like, oh my gosh, I have something else to say. I might as well hop in and I get credit for it. That's 2 out of 15. Yeah. Bam, first week.
You could see that it wasn't, you know, actually the way discussion happens in a classroom, which I thought as an online teacher, my role is to just recreate the classroom, the physical classroom environment.
So it sounds like a success story. I guess we'll just cut it off here, right?
Yeah, everything worked out great. My reviews came out back really well. They said, you know, really radical teacher. You should definitely get a tenure track job somewhere, you know, for sure. Everything went. No, it was pretty bad. it didn't happen the way I wanted. They all just started and, you know, I would send encouraging emails throughout, you know, just be like, just a reminder, you know, it's like getting to early October, like, just a reminder, you can contribute on the discussion board, you know. And I remember thinking, like, is it Blackboard? Should I, you know, sometimes, you know, after that, I started creating my own separate WordPress site for classes, but, you know, like, is it just something you're going to go Blackboard? Am I just not communicating it correctly? And then all the posts came in really back heavy just at the end of the semester, just like anything else. And it was probably the least organic conversations I've ever seen in my life, where there's just people just vomiting on the screen of just things that they didn't really care about. And it was just, you know, and I would, because in Blackboard, one of my least favorite things about Blackboard is there's no word count calculator on it. Which makes stuff really, or not to my knowledge, which makes things very frustrating. So I have to copy paste discussion posts into Microsoft Word or another word processor and see how many words there are. And there were always, you know, around 300, 301, 302, which tells you usually, well, they're typing with, you know, an eye at the bottom of the screen waiting until they reach that magic number 300 and then just done.
Totally. You know, can I make like a plug? I have a Chrome extension called Word Count. So if that's plugged in, you just highlight anything on the screen, you click the W, you know, icon in it, and it tells you the word count. That's helped me as a teacher a lot. Okay, keep going. I feel like there should be like a sound there of like da dun dun, like the reading rainbow. So clearly they were just doing that. We've all been there. We've probably been on both sides of it. We've wanted to just do the minimum, and we've seen that in students who are teaching. So this is an example of you setting it up so well, right? You had thought this through. You had bad examples of online discussion in the past, and you saw a way to fix it. And there's something weird there about sometimes our plans don't really work out the way we want. Is there a better lesson than that?
No, it's just that, you know, in terms of being, you know, someone who, you know, has a full-time job now, and part of it is, you know, a lot of it is distance and online instruction. I gave up trying to recreate the physical classroom a while ago.
Right.
And noticed that there are different things that you can do. And you know, not to sound negative, but having online discussions, fruitful online discussions, is it's very difficult. And it's extremely, no matter how well-meaning you are or how, you know, fervent you are about it, it's very, very difficult to facilitate that. And sometimes these kind of placeholders of, you know, discussion boards do every week are a good thing, because they allow you to kind of have a built-in structure. And while theoretically it's very ugly to think about, you know, discussion, it's like walking up in front of the classroom and being like, you have 5 minutes to respond to this question I just asked you.
Yeah. And I think if this were kind of like a copy of This American Life, right about now is where kind of the moving, thoughtful music would play. And I would kind of like let that linger a little bit so people could think about, yeah, and I'm gonna move on and have to do better next time.
Absolutely.
If you want to keep up with those clever folks from Old Dominion University, you can follow Shelley Rodrigo on Twitter at @rrodrigo, Sarah Spangler at @Sarah_Spangler, that's Sarah with an H, Dan Richards at @DP_Richards, and Megan Mize at @MaryQuinn. That's not Mary like Mary Queen of Scots, it's Mary like Mary that's happy, or Mary Brandy Buck, and Quinn with two N's on the end, Mary Quinn. You get it? Okay. So now let's hear four short clips from teachers who feel a little more successful about some of the ways they set up for class. I want to start with two folks talking about the big picture of how they set up, starting with Samuel Stinson from Ohio University, whose story is a good transition, I think, as it talks about those tricky issues of online conversations.
I'm sure that you've noticed how students may perform better in synchronous, physical classroom spaces than in asynchronous, online-only classes. It's difficult to take advantage of instructor ethos and group ethos in real time, online, like we can in physical classrooms. Some students may stay motivated just through self-discipline, but I'm convinced that students require group ethos and instructor ethos to do their best work. That's why when I prepare to teach, I try to first plan how we will make the best use of physical spaces before planning online activities. For example, having students begin to participate in class discussion forums while meeting in a computer lab is one way I encourage participation in the forums online while out of class. That way, students may transition to online spaces from an existing face-to-face rhetorical situation and relationship with other students.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Huerdine. I'm a big believer in making technology complement pedagogy and not the other way around. I prepare for classes by finding digital versions of things I want students to access, readings, videos, music, lyrics, etc. I also plan students' writing around the types of writing they are likely to come across on a daily basis. For instance, students this fall semester will compose an interview synthesis in which they can write, speak, perform, or create the synthesis using Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, or Reddit conversations they've recreated.
After hearing some of that big picture thinking, let's hear two more stories that get a little bit more specific, where people are talking a little more about even specific technologies they use. Maybe there's something there that will strike you and something that you'll want to Google yourself and try to figure out more about.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Gianfrancisco, and I'm a teacher at Myron B. Thompson Academy in Honolulu. We're migrating from the online learning management system, Moodle, to Canvas this school year, so I've spent a lot of time preparing my class files for the new format. Many of my documents are rather simple, like Word documents and PDF files, but we also use tools like Google Docs for collaborative spaces. I also find sites like VoiceThread to be particularly useful, as they encourage students to include voice or video recordings rather than just written words. One of my favorite assignments allows students to analyze a portion of Frankenstein in the style of their choosing, so I've gotten really interesting digital assignments, like a YouTube video of a student-constructed Minecraft world focusing on the creature. The kids always inspire me with their skills, even though I consider myself to be fairly technologically savvy.
This is Colin Charlton. I am the writing program coordinator for University of Texas Pan American in South Texas. This semester, I'm going to be teaching a graduate class for teacher preparation for the teaching assistants in the writing program, and I'm teaching a English 1301, which is a first semester, first year writing class. So I'm basically teaching the teachers and the students that they'll be working with. When I'm getting ready for the semester, what I found this summer is that I'm building an awful lot of new forms, and I think that's how I usually get started with the semester. So getting ready and thinking about what I'm going to do in those two classes and how I'm going to integrate them and have some crossover opportunities. I've spent the last 3 weeks building an iBook textbook for high school students that will be used in a college prep class. And I have built a new minimalist Wix site that only has like 5 links on it for my 1301. And I've also been building a professional development iBook that the lecturers and TAs will use for the upcoming year. So basically, I challenged myself to build a whole lot of large texts. And that helps me collect all my ideas. It helps me reflect on the other things I've used in the past that have worked and haven't worked so well. But I find myself always using new forms or old forms in a different way. And it just happens that this year I'm all about the iBook and how to use that in very interesting ways.
You can learn more about the work that these smart folks are doing at the various online spaces they inhabit. Samuel Stinson is on Twitter at StinSSD. Jennifer Huerdine is on Twitter at Huerdine. That's Huerdine. You can learn about Elizabeth Jan Francisco School at ethompson.org. There's a P in there. And Colin Charlton blogs at colincharlton.blogspot.com. And he co-eds Crosspole, Composing the New Community, a journal of transitions for high school and college writing teachers, which is up at crosspole-journal.com. And I want to say that you can check out the webpage for Plugs Play Pedagogy podcast to get more information about these clever people, but when I'm recording right now, we don't actually have a page yet, so I can't tell you where that will be. Oh, well. With that, episode 1 is over. Don't hesitate to start a conversation with me about this stuff. Tweet to me at Kay Stedman. Use the hashtag PlugsPlay. That's like a plural plugs, right? Because there's lots of plugs that we're playing with. Can you remember that? I hope so. If you record an audio response to something you heard here, I would love to include you in future episodes. You can tell that I like including people because I never know what to say myself. Speaking of future episodes, right now, the plan is for my September show to focus on teaching philosophy statements, which so many people on the job market are probably drafting right now. So if you're interested in being involved in that episode in any capacity, or if you know someone who might be big or small, well, I mean, big or small involvement. It doesn't matter if the person is big or small. So you can have big or small involvement if you're a big or a small person. It doesn't really matter. Just let me know, okay? I'm going to have a website eventually that I'll be able to tell you about. Just Google this or tweet at me or email me. Be patient. Plugs Play Pedagogy is licensed by a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 4.0 International License, which means that you may legally distribute and remix this file without asking my permission, as long as you give me credit and you don't make any money for it. The theme music you heard at the beginning of the episode is by Cactus May, a graduate student in rhetoric and composition at Ohio University. You can find more of his work at heycactus.weebly.com. You also heard 2 tracks that are freely available at ocremix.org, Light Your Way by AMT and Neblix, and now you're hearing Blue Lightning by Disco Dan. Many thanks to Courtney Danforth and Harley Ferris of Kairos Cast for their encouragement and support in getting the show off the ground. Also thanks to the many other staff of Kairos and Writing Commons, including Cheryl Ball and Joe Moxley, who have answered all of my many questions. I'm Kyle Stedman, recording in beautiful Rockford, Illinois. And seriously, why don't you live in the Midwest in the summer? I don't understand. It's amazing here. In any case, this is Plugs Play Pedagogy.